Good afternoon. Can you hear me all right? Perfect. Just a lot of echo here. So first of all, thank you for joining. I know it's like right after lunch. So hopefully you've had enough coffee. Got a lot of stuff to cover. So we'll keep it pretty fast-paced, so hopefully I won't put you to sleep. Real quick, I'm Karan Deepanand. I'm a group program manager on the Windows Azure team. My team is primarily responsible for the end-to-end management and user experience story for Azure. So anything you see you don't like, I'm to be blamed. I really can't blame anyone else. So I'd love to hear feedback, as well as a lot of new stuff coming on the roadmap. So just be honest, and we'd love to hear what your thoughts are. Yesterday, we did one session, which was the introduction to Azure. And then, of course, Scott did a pretty large session. So how many of you attended either one of those two sessions? Almost all of them. Okay. For those of you who didn't, there will be a little bit of overlap with the content, and hopefully that should get you up to speed on what Windows Azure is. And then we get really deep into how to do management and monitoring of your services. So that's what I want to cover. And my real goal here is this is supposed to be a level 300 deep dive session. So we'll get into a lot of demos, real code, real debugging of right services. So let's keep it interactive. It's a small enough audience that I can take questions along the way. You don't have to wait. So just raise your hand and we'll jump deep into it. So before we get started, let's do a real quick recap of, this was pretty much covered in yesterday's sessions, but a very quick recap of what is Windows Azure. And you've probably seen the slide enough number of times that it's too repetitive, but we want to keep repeating the same point on, essentially, think of Windows Azure as server on steroids. Server becomes a data center, and it's a self-managed, automated cloud compute platform for you. But other than that, the way you develop code doesn't fundamentally change. So all languages you're used to, all runtimes you're used to, they all translate. But there are a lot of new scenarios and a lot of new services that can be built because inherently your code is now running in a cloud, which is connected system to other services. The beautiful part about a cloud is it's usage-based. So it's only you pay for what you use, which means if you want to develop something, test it out, spin it down, you don't have to keep paying for the hardware. That's very, very important. And your productivity is directly proportional to what you pay for. So you don't have to necessarily worry about buying too much, buying too little. It'll always be available when you need it. And, of course, all the services, and yesterday we spent a lot of time talking about all the services are managed for you, so you don't have to, as developers, ever have to worry about how the infrastructure is being run. That's our job. The service, the environment, automatically takes care of managing the infrastructure for you. So you focus primarily on your applications. That's the whole goal with this. And we'll get into more details about Elastic, scale out, scale in. So if a service becomes very successful, you automatically get the Elastic scalability of Azure, so you don't have to fundamentally do anything different. We'll talk about a few design principles real quick so that your service is inherently elastic. Otherwise, you'll have to redevelop, re-architect. So we want to avoid that. We'll follow a few principles, which I'll talk about in the next slide. If you do that, your service and your code is automatically elastic, and hence it'll always be very economical for you to use it because you can either spin it down. If there's not enough users or load, you can spin it up if it becomes more successful. So the rest of the content is common regardless of whether you're building a mobile app that uses Azure or you're building a line of business application. It doesn't matter. The principles that are here essentially remain the same regardless of the kind of application you're trying to build or the clients you're serving, of course. There are different formats. You would rather JSON is an output, XML could be an output, just a web service could be an output, doesn't matter. But some of the principles of how your application should be architected and hence managed remain the same when you're looking at the core design principles. So one thing to remember, in your code, whenever you're developing the design or doing the design of the application, do not design for scale up. Always design for scale out. This is a very fundamental principle which makes your application both scalable as well as cost economical, which is instead of requiring the server to be bigger and bigger and bigger, expect to have more of the servers. So if one server goes down, your application continues to run. That's a very big shift than how we were used to doing programming in the past, which is you need more memory, you can get more memory. You need more processing power, you get more processing power. But now with the scale-out architecture, assume that you just buy more servers or provision more servers as you need to add capacity. So you're not adding more larger VMs or larger machines, you're adding more of those same machines. The same architecture also helps you with redundancy. So if one machine was to die, so you should always assume a machine's going to die. That's how we've designed Windows Azure. Hardware, disks, network, power, something will go wrong. The entire infrastructure is designed to make sure that if any one of those things go bad, your application still remains live and still serving end users. Just the fact that the application is now designed to be scaled out, which means there are a lot of different parts to the application, one of the core design principles is make sure it's asynchronous. So don't assume tight coupling. Don't assume the machines are co-located. They're usually in the same data center. They should usually same behind the same load balancer. But don't assume that you will get a response in a certain time. Always design an application to be asynchronous. So send a call, do a short timeout, retry. Short timeout, retry. So that's a very, very core principle that kind of helps you, one, take in a lot of load, and at the same time, one tier of your application, whether it's web front ends or it could be back end, cannot be the bottleneck of your applications. You can independently scale them out. That's very, very core. So with that, I'll probably not spend too much time on the slide. I would strongly recommend looking at yesterday's session. I'm assuming they'll all be recorded and available to go deep into a lot of these principles so you can, you know, when you're going back to your drawing board and thinking of your next big application, some of these principles can be embedded in the core design to start with. So with that background in mind, let's get into understanding what are the key things you have to manage and learn about in Windows Azure. So let's take a step back. The way we build the whole service, cloud is one big black box for you. You don't have to worry about how it's run. What you look at is essentially your service, which is your application. And we give you multiple different ways. So, you know, if you are a heavy PowerShell user, there's an answer for you. If you like to build your own management tools or your own scripts, there's a REST API. And, of course, there's a management portal as well. So there's a Silverlight UI, which helps you manage your entire application and all the corresponding services which get consumed. One thing to remember, the way you authenticate, which means who you are as the owner, is identified with Windows Live ID. So when you sign up for Azure, you essentially get a Live ID. That is your token. So be careful on which Live ID you use and how you share it. Of course, we'll get into other features like co-admins, so you can add multiple people who can manage your applications in Azure. But Live ID is the way you authenticate yourself. Once you get a certificate back, you can use that certificate to either authenticate to the portal directly from Visual Studio, talking to Azure, or even using REST APIs or PowerShell. So Live ID gets your token, gets your certificate, and that certificate is what it authenticates you against any management interface to Windows Azure. So just remember that. And, of course, you have multiple different ways to connect to Azure. So let's start with the first key concept, which is how do you package? You know, most people are used to either an MS Build, an MSI, installer. That's how you typically bundle your application on-premises. You build it, you give it over to either your customer or to your IT pro, and they run a setup.exe, kind of works. With Windows Azure, it kind of works a little different, which is how you package, and hence how you configure, is defined essentially with two sets of artifacts. One is called the service definition. Service definition, we'll see that in a minute, is essentially one file which gets packaged as part of your application itself and contains all the information about which ports to secure, endpoints, access control, a lot of the diagnostics, a lot of information is in the service definition. Think of this as the manifest file that you typically build when you're building the on-premises application. The second important file is the service configuration file. And this is the best example of this is if you're using web.config today, and all the parameters that you put in web.config, the best equivalent of that is service configuration file. So anything that you need to change at runtime, anything you need to add later or define as an environment variable, typically will should be in the service configuration file. And I'll explain why that helps you. Once you build the application, apart from your binaries that you've actually built, you will have a service definition and you'll have a service configuration, and they all get zipped into a single big CS package file and gets uploaded to Windows Azure. So on-premises world, you have a setup file with manifest and configs. Azure, you again have the same binaries, but with a service definition and a service configuration file. Let's dive a little deeper into, you know, service definition versus service configuration, and that's typically the most frequently asked question when people start developing their applications with Windows Azure on when to use what and what scenarios get served by either one of those. So think of service definition as an overall definition of how my application looks like. For example, if your application has a web front end, you know, where what most customers' web browsers will hit, or a service endpoint, plus it might have a whole bunch of middle-tier servers. Some of them are doing queue processing. Some could be doing back-end image processing. And you could have multiple other tiers which could do data processing. The shape and the different parts of your application are defined in the service definition. So this is, think of this as if you were drawing the design of your application on a whiteboard. When you capture that in terms of an actual manifest, that's exactly what a service definition looks like. In addition to that, it talks about, you know, which roles talk to which point endpoints. So if your web talks to your database, or your web talks to a worker role, all those connections and communication, whether it's secure, whether it's open, whether it's an internal endpoint, external endpoint, all that is captured in the service definition. The most important point to remember with the service definition is that it cannot be changed once the application is deployed. So it's hard to change. There are some exceptions to that we'll get in a second, but it's hard to change the design of your application once the application has been deployed and running. So if you really want to change the endpoints, you want to change whether it's secure or not secure, or add more roles, essentially it means you're developing the next version of your application and you have to do a full upgrade. Let's take a quick look what a service definition file really looks like. In this example, I have one web role in my application, and the web role called the web UX. Think of this as a website, a simple site which has a front end, and it has a couple of definition files in it, which is, it talks about remote access is enabled as a specific example, which means I want to enable remote desktop access to my web server. And other things it talks about is that this website has an HTTP endpoint, and I want to expose the HTTP endpoint as a protocol to expose my web services. You can have HTTPS. You can add certificates to use with HTTPS as well. And then it talks about one more endpoint called the management service, which is restricted. It's a TCP endpoint. So essentially, you're defining all the protocols and all the ports you want to use in the service definition. And because all these ports get registered with a load balancer at application deployment, you really cannot change any of this after you build the app. And diagnostics connection string, this will really help us in the second half of the talk when you get into monitoring and diagnostics, helps you define where all your diagnostics information and debugging information is kept for the application. So you configure this one time, and you can keep changing the connection string itself later. So that's a quick service definition. Let's contrast that with the service configuration file. As I explained earlier, this is what you would normally put in your app.config or in web.config. This is where you get the runtime values, things like how many instances do I want? What database do I talk to when I'm in production versus when I'm staging? What database do I talk to when I'm still doing debugging? Which certificates to use? These are things that can keep changing as your application is still running, and you can keep updating the configuration file. And hence, there's a direct API as well as a PowerShell available to change the configuration file after the application is still deployed and running. Let's take a quick look at one sample configuration file before we jump into a real demo. This is what a typical config file would look like. For the same role that we just saw earlier, like web UX, the first thing you're defining is the instance count. How many instances of this web server do I want to run? This is what helps you, you know, scale up and scale down an application. You change that instance count from 1 to 10, and you have 10 web servers automatically running for you. Similarly, if you see the next few lines, it talks about which connection string to use to keep my logs. You can put your own connections, own variables here. For example, you could put, I really want to keep, it's Valentine's Day, I want to keep the background color of my page as pink or red. You can actually stick the background color as a configuration setting in the config file itself. And we'll see real quick on how you can read that and inherit that the setting into the application itself. Then other things like certificates, this is very important, especially if you're using HTTPS, or you need to configure remote desktop. These are certificate things that you can keep changing, so that one certificate expires, or if you think your certificate got compromised, you can keep changing it. So you get general drift that, you know, service configuration gets used for things that will keep changing at the runtime. So with that, let's just switch to seeing some real Visual Studio project in action. I have a very, very simple application here. The goal is not to build real applications, but to show you a structure and different pieces of what makes an app. So once you install the Windows Azure SDK, one thing you'll see common across all applications is, in addition to the actual projects, this is a simple .NET project. Actually, this is not even MVC. This is a standard application. I have two projects. One is called the web role, and the other called the worker role. And it's a simple daytime TCP server. The web gets a request, calls the worker role, it gets a time, and we output the time. So the application is pretty simple. But in addition to the actual code, there are two other interesting files to go look at, the service configuration and the service definition. These are files that we just looked at. And let's see what goes into the configuration first. So for my web role, you can define things like the trust level you need to run your application in, the instance count, what size of the virtual machine. So this is where you define how large or small a machine that I care about. You cannot change the machine size once you deploy it, though you can change the instance count. And the kind of endpoints that I care about. So you can add HTTP, I can add HTTPS. And the last one is very interesting and very important. That's where we define how you, the diagnostics connection string, so you can do debugging later. There are a couple of other interesting things you can add here. One is called the settings. So by default, there are a whole bunch of settings that you will see in the project when you add it. Things like remote access. This is for remote desktop. But in this sample, what I've done is I've added one custom connection string. What's the banner text? This is the text I want to change even after I've deployed the application. So if it's, you know, I'm deploying an application, let's say, to Europe versus to North America, I want to change the logo, or I want to change the text. So if in this example, I've just put a simple string of type, variable of type string called the banner text, and I'll show you how we read this at runtime and display it in the application itself. A couple of other interesting things, you can start defining a list of all the input-output ports. You can pick HTTP, which is typically port 80, and you can define, that's a very important thing to remember, you can either define a port endpoint to be internal or external. Anything which is external is available publicly. So anyone who has access to the URL of the site can actually hit that endpoint. Anything marked as internal is only available within your application. So one thing to remember, if you have sensitive data or if you have data that you don't want to share with other applications, mark the endpoint as internal only. So only your application can talk to it, but nobody else can. A couple of other things like defining local storage, and we'll get into that in a minute, which is every virtual machine that you get, even though the application is supposed to be stateless, you can still use local storage. So you can still do a temporary file that you want to write to dcolon. You can write a dcolon temp file. You can define a lot of local drives, which are part of the machine. But don't assume the machine, once the machine gets rebooted, the data in that drive will be gone. So think of this as just a local temporary storage that you can keep defining. I just put a 10 MB files here. So this is for the web role. You'll see the worker role have a very similar configuration as well. Of course, the UI, the way to do it is pretty straightforward on the default settings, but you can actually go and change this and add a lot of custom configuration as well. So, for example, everything that we just saw, you know, as those settings is also available, where my setting name, banner text, is captured as a setting type. And the other things I've got is I hope nobody is recording it. Well, it looks like the video is being recorded. So it has my connection string. It has my access key. Well, I'll have to go change all of that after this. But that being said, you can stick in the username passwords. Hopefully, you should not do it in clear text the way I'm doing it, but read it from a file. And let's now look at real quick at the service definition file. And service definition is where we had captured the settings of the endpoints and the bindings that you want to have. So the to go back, let's just run this application real quick to show you what it really does. And
is it also possible to define next to the instances where the geographic location
of your... So the question was, in addition to defining the instances, can you define in configuration where which region it gets deployed to? The short answer is no, because you have the same application that can get deployed to multiple geos. It's at deployment time that you pick which geo it gets deployed to. And I'll show you that demo. So it's not, when you're developing the app, you don't have to worry about where it gets deployed. When you create the service that you need to deploy it to, at that point you can pick whether you want to deploy it to West Europe, anywhere in Europe, North America, Australia, or APAC. And those regions are at deployment time only. So this is a very simple app. And what we did was, when you're building and debugging the app locally, what really happens is there's a Azure Compute Emulator, which is your local debug tool, and it spins up, in this case I have one instance each of the same web fabric role and the worker role. The interesting property here to really look at is when you're doing local debugging, you can set you can get the property that tells you that you're running in a local debug environment on your machine versus when you're running it in Azure. How this helps you is if you have a configuration set that you use locally, let's assume you have a temporary database that you test with or a temporary account that you test with, you can look up the value of whether is emulated is set, use a different configuration set, or when it runs is running in Azure, you can switch to using a different set of accounts altogether. And let me show you the same thing with running in Azure. So I have one of these apps deployed in Azure as well. And let's contrast this with first time run. So in this case, it's running in Windows Azure. So the is emulated is set to false. And in the other case, it's running in the Windows Azure Compute Emulator. So this setting helps you do a lot of local debugging and set the right properties, as well as when you switch, it automatically starts reading data from the settings that are applicable to the Azure environment. And let me show you this. Okay, so let me stop debugging this and show you one other interesting part of this. So in addition to defining profiles, which are either local or in Azure, you can also define profiles which are whether in a staging environment or in a production environment. So if you want to manage multiple versions of your application, you keep continuously developing, you can also define what settings to use when you have the app deployed in a staging environment, which is typically a different database, different storage account, different set of credentials, than what you do in production. And when the application switches, it picks up the right set of settings there as well. So that was just a very, very quick overview of how you do basic configuration and packaging of an application in Azure. And you can use that for doing local debugging, cloud debugging, cloud deployment as well. So it's concept number one that you need to remember, and what should be in your service definition versus service configuration. The second interesting concept to remember with Azure is the whole notion of fault and upgrade domains. So once you actually build an app, it's very, very important and very critical that there is no downtime. So if you're building a simple line of business application or a consumer application, once the application is deployed, Azure provides you with a lot of different knobs and functionality to make sure that you can keep that service up and running. Even if if there's hardware failure, we take care of it. But even if you want to build the next version and upgrade it, we provide mechanisms called the upgrade domain to help you with that. Let's look at that real quick. Fault domain is a concept specific to Azure, which is if you deploy more than one instance, Azure makes sure that those two instances get deployed across two different hardware racks, different load balancers, different power distribution. So it's very, very important that to get the 99.95% availability SLA that we guarantee, if you have the instance count of any role as 2, what Azure will do is it will take one instance and deploy it on a different rack in a data center, and take the second instance and deploy it on a different rack, which is under a different load balancer, so that even if one whole, not just the server or disk, but the whole rack was to die, your application will still be running. So it's very critical. That's what's called a fault domain. So we've got a whole bunch of different algorithms to figure out different points of failure in a data center, and that's what gets defined as a fault domain. So you don't have to understand how we have to do the load balancing and allocation, but the point simply being to use fault domains, by default, every application gets fault domain. If you are building a multi-geo application, as an example, you can set more fault domains. So you can actually define fault domains to be 5 or 10. I think max was 5 right now, an update of 10. So that you can make sure that even if you have multiple points of failures or 2 racks go down, your application will still be up and running. So, and essentially, the whole goal of more fault domains means higher probability of your application availability. The second concept, this is what impacts you, is an upgrade, the notion of an upgrade domain. The fact that you have an application and they have multiple instances running of the application, you get the ability to take one server down at a time and upgrade it. And this is an upgrade in case we want to update either the base image itself, so if you're applying patches to Windows Azure, we automatically use this information, but also for your own application, if you define 5 web roles, you can take one instance down, put the next version or the upgraded version into it, and I'll show you how you do that real quick. Once that's up and running, the next upgrade domain will be used, and the application gets updated as well. And so on and so forth till all your upgrade domains are cycled through, and your application completely automatically rolls over to the next version. The interesting thing is the goal of fault domain is to make sure that the more instances you use, the more availability you get. The goal of upgrade domain is to give you flexibility of how you want the rolling upgrade behavior for your application. Let's visualize this on what both these concepts really mean. Once you set the fault domain, Windows Azure will go and pick the right set of hardware and placement in the data center, so it's definitely spread across 2 different racks. Yes. You can influence fault domains. So if you have larger number of fault domains set in your application, of course, if you need to set large number of fault domains, you need to have larger number of instances. Then we make sure that it's not only spread across 2 racks, it's on multiple racks across multiple load balancers. So the more instances, you can set a higher number of fault domains, of course. Beyond 5, it really doesn't help you because the number of single point of failures in a data center kind of starts becoming next to 0 at 5. Other than specifying the value, there's not a whole lot you can do to influence it. But upgrade domains, that is something you can definitely influence, and that's very critical. So once you define an upgrade domain, Windows Azure's Fabric Controller will make sure that it picks the upgrade domain across both the fault domains as well, so that at any given time, if you're upgrading a machine or an instance, it will pick one instance from fault domain 1, one instance from fault domain 2, so that both of them get upgraded together. Once you're done with that, it picks the upgrade domain 2 and starts rolling. So essentially, these 2 parameters is what informs Windows Azure to make sure which machines to upgrade at what time and guarantee the SLA of uptime that you need to offer to your customers. So,
is there a form of automated testing once an upgrade has been done?
Right. So the question was, is there a way of automated testing when an upgrade is being done? So yes, there are 2 modes in how upgrades can happen. One is called an automatic mode, in which case you give the new application package and let Windows Azure update the packages automatically for you, which means it will update domain 1. It will check whether the endpoint is up. Once the endpoint is up, it automatically starts upgrading the upgrade domain 2, and so on and so forth till the entire application is done. If you're building a very, very critical business-critical application, most customers not only want the package to get deployed correctly, but they also want to do their own testing. So that's the second mode, and I'll show you in the portal, which is you can choose a manual mode for doing upgrades as well. In the manual mode, what happens is, with the new application package, first upgrade domain gets updated, and Azure stops at that point. It waits for you to say, I'm going to validate, this looks correct, go on with the second upgrade. Second upgrade domain happens, and so on and so forth. So you get to orchestrate the entire upgrade process as opposed to letting it automatically happen. So both options are available, and it really depends on how much control do you want when the upgrade is happening. The good thing with manual is it's a lot easier to do a rollback because you've tested one upgrade domain. If it doesn't look right, if the application doesn't look correct, you can quickly switch back to the other version as well. And in terms of extending the same concept of how you do deployment and upgrade, the other thing to remember is you can definitely use the portal, but you can also use Visual Studio itself. So if you're doing debugging, if you're building applications in multiple versions, if you're trying it out, you can use any of these tools. So pick a tool that you're comfortable with, and there are different ways to start with managing your Windows Azure application. So Visual Studio, we'll definitely use that as an example, and the portal. But in addition to that, there are two other tools. CS Manage is the one where you can use, it's a command line tool. So if you're building, if you have a large build system, or you use TFS, or you use any other automation, you can actually wrap all these scripts using CS Manage and start deploying. So if you get bigger with your application, you can use either PowerShell or you can use CS Manage as two scripting tools as well to be able to manage your application. In addition, there are a lot of third-party tools as well. In fact, for my demo, I'm going to be using a very commonly used tool for storage management. It's called Windows Azure Storage Explorer. I love that tool. So I'll talk about the big ecosystem of other tools people have built on top of Azure so that it can help you manage both your compute as well as other assets like storage. The one big investment we've recently made was in a lot of PowerShell. So everything you can do through UI, you can also use it through PowerShell. So even if you're not a PowerShell expert, it doesn't matter. There are a lot of samples. And the biggest benefit of PowerShell is you can automate it to run. It's part of your build process. So every time a lot of developers check in, you can kick off an automated build. And in addition to that, you can kick off a lot of the configuration settings, turning on diagnostics, deploying the build to Azure. And it really, really helps with the automation story as well as diagnostic story. So if you haven't tried the PowerShell scripts, give it a shot. A whole bunch of easy samples to go use that ship with the commandlets itself. back to the actual deployment. So those are tools, but the actual deployment. So we talked yesterday, and I'm going to repeat that real quick, is for every service or application that you create in Azure, let's call it myfubar.com, you get two environments for each service. One is a production environment, which is accessible using foobar.cloudapp.net to all the entire, anyone externally. At the same time, you also get a mirror environment called the staging environment, which is essentially just a long GUID .cloudapp.net so that it's not easily discoverable from the outside world. But that's an environment you can keep either the previous version or the next version and use it. What this helps you with is you can actually not just deploy applications and upgrade them. You can also have two versions running simultaneously and just swap once you're ready to deploy it. That's what we call the whip swap, which is in addition, not doing the in-place upgrade, which is doing upgrade domain one at a time. You develop a completely different version of the application, which does not have to be backward compatible with the previous one. You can completely swap, and at the same time, near instantaneously, your customers get directed to the new one. So a few things to remember. When picking one method over the other, in-place upgrade is very powerful when you know what you're doing. So it's very easy to screw up in-place upgrade because you need to make sure that your database schemas can talk with both your current version and the next version of the application. You need to make sure that your users might be hitting, some users might be hitting new version, some users might be hitting the old version. So unless you're sure what you're doing, in-place upgrade is really, really hard to orchestrate and get it right. Of course, people who've been doing it with on-premises software as well, kind of makes sense. So you can have two schemas, roll in one, roll out another one, make sure users get authenticated correctly. But the fact that you don't control which user will get sent to which version, because the load balancer automatically sends the users to every upgrade domain in a round-robin fashion. You need to make sure that your application, if you're doing in-place upgrade, can sustain both your new version and the current version simultaneously. If you're not comfortable doing that, that's when the WIP swap really helps you. And I'll be very honest, for most of our own services, so my team builds the whole Azure portal, we just usually just do a WIP swap. The benefit of WIP swap is you get two identical environments, and once you've fully tested and validated that your new environment works just fine, all you need to do is swap the IP addresses. Well, you don't have to do that part, or Azure does it automatically for you. Customers will never even see the old version. All 100% of your traffic automatically starts going to the new version, and you don't have to worry about two versions running in parallel. The interesting point here is WIP swaps typically works easily and well in cases where your state is completely externalized. So if you're maintaining a lot of state in an application, it's a bad practice if you're keeping a lot of state anyway, because in general you want an app to be scalable, should be stateless. But if you're maintaining a lot of state in your application, then using WIP swap is hard because you need to drain the data out. But if your application has all the state externalized to a database or to storage, then doing WIP swap is pretty easy because there's no state to be carried forward when you're doing WIP swap. Anyway, a lot of talk, but let me show you how you actually do this in practice. So what I have here is this is the Windows Azure Management Portal, if you haven't used this before. And what I have here is for the same application, it's called the Introduction to Fabric, I have two versions of the application deployed. One to the production environment, and second to the staging environment. They're essentially similar-looking applications. One is running with this big GUID, so it's really hard for anyone to find out, even if you're running a version of the application, the next one. It's not discoverable. And then, of course, you have the externally visible and usable version called the intro-to-fabric.cloudapp.net. So I have two versions running simultaneously, and one has a name called Hello Fabric, and the other one has, you know, just updated a name called Hello Windows Azure version 2. So I have the next version of the application sitting right here. So what I do is I can pick the production and staging and hit WIP swap. What WIP swap will do now is I have two completely simultaneous running versions of the application, and it starts routing all the new traffic to the new virtual IP that's allocated to the staging environment. So the next time a user hits, let me hit a control F5, the intro to cloud app, let me bring this up, sorry. Yep, so let me, when I hit intro to cloud app, I need to stop caching this. So if you saw the GUID version, it rolled back to the older version, which actually did have the Hello Fabric. And this one, for some reason, still not picking up. That's a bad idea for WIP swap. Okay. Perfect. So for some reason, the old version got rolled back to the staging, but the new version hasn't been picked up, which is weird. So... Sorry? Yeah, that's a good point. I should try. That's when Firefox helps. Please don't record that part. So, let's try that. Okay. There you go. Thank you so much. So, apart from browser caching, most users will see the new version of the application near instantaneously. So thank you again. Let's get back to... So that's a very simple WIP swap. Essentially, all you have to do is, once your test team or once you're comfortable with the application running correctly in the new version, you come to the portal, all through PowerShell, all through REST API, come and give the command and automatically switch the virtual IPs. So what happens when the user currently logs in? They will lose a session. So that's the whole notion, which is if your session state is on the web role, you have a problem. One of the tips, simple trick that most people use is they use AppFabric, or what used to be called AppFabric caching, now it's just called Azure caching. They keep all the session state information in either a database or in a cache, so that even if the web role goes down or it happens, it has to be web swap, they still read the data and the session state from the cache. So as much as possible, externalize the state from your compute, and you'll get a lot of all the benefits of the Azure Compute platform. So good question there. So that was a real quick web swap. With the recent release of SDK 1.5, it's actually been a few months now. Remember earlier I'd mentioned that you cannot change a lot of things which you put in your CS definition file. So for example, if you had one web role and one worker role, it's hard to change that. With SDK 1.5, we added the ability to add new roles on demand. So if an application, for example, requires or design changes and you need to add one more role that does caching because you realize that you really don't have good caching story, you can add more roles without bringing your application down. So that's if you're using SDK 1.5, which most people should be using now, you can do that. In addition, you can actually change the virtual machine size as well. So now that's a setting which earlier, once you pick the virtual machine to be either small or medium, you were stuck with it. You can also change that when you're doing an in-place upgrade. Now, let's quickly understand other factors when you would use web swap or in-place upgrade or just delete a deployment and create a new one. One thing to remember is when you create a new deployment, let's say intro to Fabric, you get assigned a virtual IP. That virtual IP address is fixed and allocated to your service. And it's very, very important because if you're building, let's say, a payment processing part of your application and you use, let's say, PayPal needs to ask you or will ask you, give me the IP address from which you're going to be sending the request. And they typically do that so that they can do whitelisting. You know, that's a very, very simple way to make sure that, you know, it's not spam. And typically what happens in those scenarios is you don't want to lose the IP that got assigned to you. So make sure that, you know, you are not frequently deleting the whole deployment of the service and creating a new one. So you either use in-place upgrade or use web swap. But because if you delete the actual deployment itself, you lose the virtual IP allocated to it. In addition to that, I mean, what this means is it's very hard to know what your application will look like 2 years from now or 6 months from now, 7 months from now. So make sure, you know, you have some room for adding either more roles or more endpoints. Keep them internal or use configuration settings to change things later. But try to keep your service definition fairly fixed. You can add more roles. That capability is there with SDK 1.5. So you can keep extending your application. But if you're unsure of which ports you would need or which endpoints you need or which certificates you'll use, keep it generic. Read it from configuration file as opposed to baking it into your service definition. With mainly the goal that you should not have to delete and recreate your deployments. That's very, very critical. The other thing is, even if you really have to go, your application is fundamentally different, you really need to do it, then one other thing you do is, in this example we just took, I had intro to fabric.cloudapp.net. Most customers end up getting their own domain name, so you get foobar.com mapping to that domain name. So you can always do fancy stuff with DNS mapping, so that you can give that DNS name as the external name and never have to worry about what the actual name is. So if you lose Intro to Fabric, next time let's assume you delete Intro to Fabric as my domain name, CNAME, you come back and somebody else has taken it. There's no guarantee, because the minute you delete it, it's no longer yours. So if you come back and you don't get Intro to Fabric again, you can actually get Intro to Fabric 2.cloudapp.net. Hence, it's very important for you, you know, if you have externally promised domain names that people are using, use foobar.com and map it to the CNAME. Simple configuration. So that's another trick that you can typically use to make sure that your external services don't get impacted when you upgrade and delete deployments. Okay. So this brings to me my most favorite part about scaling and auto-scaling. So one good thing about the whole platform is if you go through all the steps, making sure it's all stateless, we use caching, use databases, one thing you get automatically with Azure is the notion of scaling. And that's primarily because of the application being stateless. which means we can create more web roles, worker roles, and you know, remove them. It doesn't matter because all your state is sitting in a storage or in a database or in a cache. Essentially, what scaling does is it creates a clone, or as many clones as you want, of the same virtual machine with the same application packages. So you just have more of the same capacity without you doing anything. So the only thing you have to do from your side is increase the scale count, and the fabric will take care of creating identical copies of the virtual machines and making sure that the load balancer can talk to all of them. So if you were talking to one instance, you add 10, it will automatically start spraying requests to all 10 of them. Nothing that you have to do different except for increasing the scale count. And the way to do that is in the service configuration file, all you need to do is come and add the instance count or increase the instance count from 1 to high. Let me quickly show you how you would do that. So in this case, I'm running my worker role with one instance. So only one instance for my web role. So I pick the deployment that I want to increase the instances for and hit configure. And right in the portal itself, I can edit the configuration file and increase the instance count from 1 to, let's say, 5, just because you know, you can start hitting this URL right now. And let me increase the worker role count from 1 to 3. That's one other thing to remember. If between your different roles, web role and worker role, you're not using a lot of synchronous calls, for example, you're not directly making service calls, but you're using something like a queue or a message, it's very easy to decouple the scale of your front ends from your back ends. That's another trick we discussed yesterday, which is if you use asynchronous communication between your different parts of the application, you can dynamically increase only your web role. If it's Christmas, a lot of people are visiting your website. Or if there are a lot of orders, you can just increase the back end, and you can dynamically change one or the other, and they're independent of each other. You come and you can edit this, and you start seeing that the entire deployment starts picking up the new configuration. In this case, the only configuration it will detect that has changed is the instance count, which means your application will not take any downtime. So even though you're changing the configuration, your end users never see that the application is getting impacted. And meanwhile, Azure, in 7 seconds, to next refresh, will start spinning up more and more clones. So typically it takes about, on an average, 4 to 5 minutes for the new machine to get spun up. Of course, 10 machines will get spun up in parallel. So, and in about 5 minutes, your service, through a single click in the UI, actually goes from being one role, one web role, to 5 web roles and 3 worker roles. So that's how easy it is to manually scale a service in Azure. The interesting part is you don't really want to keep sitting and watching the load and keep increasing and decreasing the scale count. So we recently released a guidance on how you do auto-scaling. So how many of you have used the Enterprise Library Pack? There's an Enterprise Library Pack. Awesome. Oh, great. Actually, probably the first 2 people I've met who actually use this thing, so that's great. Which means you're probably building like really serious applications with Azure or for Adobe apps. So what this does is it has, of course, a lot of guidance, but it also has application block code that you can use to specify the rules that you want to use to do automatic scaling. In general, be careful with how you use this because if you end up scaling too much, you'll get a big bill at the end of the month. And there are constraints available, which are called the constraint rules. So there are two rules, types of rules. One is constraint-based, where you define the max and the minimum instance count. This guarantees that you will never go beyond certain number of web or worker role instances, and hence your cost of running your application will never exceed. The other one is, think of the reactive rules, which is you really don't care, except for denial of service attacks, you really don't care about how many users are hitting your application. If more users are hitting your app, you want to automatically scale it up. So you don't want to, so for example, you released the cool new Windows 8 mobile app, and a lot of people started using it. You don't want to be sitting and watching how the usage is at night when you're sleeping to say, oh, I need to upgrade it, because you really don't want to give a 404. It's important in those scenarios to use reactive rules, where what it does is it looks at performance counters from the machine, and you specify certain set of rules that says if your CPU is more than 60% for 3 hours, automatically scale up. And scale operation takes, as I just showed you, 4 to 5 minutes. So you can, even when you're sleeping, overnight, your service will get scaled up automatically or scaled down automatically. So that, and this is actually, there's a beautiful white paper which explains how you define the min count, how it scales up. So we can probably do an entire 1 hour session only on how to do auto scaling correctly. But the point being, if you really are anticipating or don't know how many users will be hitting an application, that's typically true for more consumer applications. We don't know, the kind of expected load. For line of business applications, you usually know how many people are using it. The whole auto scaling block really helps you. Do make sure you use the constraint rules as well, so you're not, raking up a big bill just because somebody hit a denial of service or just liked the website or kept refreshing it. So with that, I'll just give you a laundry list of a couple of other things to remember, a couple of small tips and tricks. There's a notion of a co-admin. So we talked earlier about Windows Live ID as being your primary way to authenticate. Once you create an account, you can add up to 10 co-admins. I think up to 5 or 10 admins. I need to go check on that. And you can add more people with Live IDs, so whichever account you have. And they have permissions on the entire subscription. That's one thing you need to remember. It's not only for the service or the application. When you add a co-admin, a joint administrator, they have access to the entire subscription. Of course, you can create multiple subscriptions, and that is typically what you would do in case you were, it's a larger company, or you have friends or people you collaborate with. You can create multiple subscriptions, but when you add an admin, the admin has access to all services within that subscription. So remember that. The other thing is, you can, for all your automation purposes, including through Visual Studio, you can download management certificates. So you don't have to necessarily type your username, password for Live ID every time you authenticate. Once you can do it one time, you get the certificate, and that's a settings file, and you can use that with PowerShell, you can use that with Visual Studio, and that's a way of automating without entering Live ID passwords. So do any of you use TFS today? Wow. That's actually pretty awesome. So if you're using TFS, one of the ways to automate builds and deployments from TFS to go directly to Azure is to use one of these management certificates so that you can actually use a certificate to authenticate against the service as opposed to somebody watching and entering and prompting for the password and entering a Live ID password every time. The other common thing that we've learned the hard way across most customers use it is make sure that you keep all your production services in a separate subscription. How that helps is when you add co-admins when you add a lot of people to the same subscription who can play with it, it's very easy to delete and drop databases, drop services. So if you're really serious about keeping your application uptime, we put a lot of stuff in the infrastructure to make sure the application doesn't go down. But there's nothing we can do to prevent against stupid users. So just be very careful about production services versus what you're doing in development. So it's very, very critical that you lock down access to what's running in production, especially if it's either mission critical or it's sensitive data. Okay, so with that, I'm going to take a quick water break and shift the focus from doing deployments and services to actually doing monitoring. So, any questions so far? Yes.
About the reactive, can you, for example, and also create a rule that it will automatically increase the disk size where your databases reside when the disk is almost getting full or something like that?
Let me rephrase the question first. So, the question was for reactive rules, can you also automatically increase and decrease the size of the disk on which the database is kept? So one thing, typically don't keep a database on any of your compute roles because there's no guarantee that if the role gets recycled, gets deployed, or destroyed, the database will be there. If you're keeping temp files and you don't care about losing it, yes. With SDK 1.5, now you can change the size of local storage dynamically. So you can write a reactive rule to actually increase the size of local storage if you see my log file has started filling up the space. But in general, if it's a database, use SQL Azure, use Azure Storage, use a third-party service. Don't keep your databases and data, which needs to be persisted, on a compute role, because there's no guarantee that it'll be there. But the answer is reactive rules. Yes, you can do pretty much do anything with the reactive rules. It's just anything you can do through the API or through the portal, you can pretty much write a rule for that. Okay, so let's shift focus to how do you do monitoring of so. Okay, one question.
When you spin up another like instance of the role, mm-hmm. are you sure that the user is going to keep the same instance or she might be keeping the new instance?
Actually, good question. In general, there are no guarantees on which instance the user will hit. That's a principle which is a service, from all practical purposes, just a role for you. Whether it has one instance or 50 instances, the user never understands it. Of course, it causes problems when you need to do things like sticky sessions. So that's one of the most commonly asked questions on how do you implement sticky sessions. There is a notion of pinning to load balancer, but that's a very, very hacky way or a very difficult way to go do sticky sessions. The best way to do is externalize the state session state to either a cache if you want care about performance. If you're not worried about performance, you can keep it in a database as well. But that's the best way to do sticky sessions. But there's another white paper if you really want to do pinning of which load balancer, which instance it goes to. But typically, don't assume that when the new instance gets spun up, the user will keep going to the same instance. Okay. So, before we get into like how you do monitoring in for Azure services, there's a fundamental principle difference between how you do monitoring on premises for your existing server software and how you have to think about cloud. Typically, when you're building an application and running it on a server that you control, it's a server that you actually have access to. It's a physical machine or it's a virtual machine you can walk up to. You can remote desktop. You can set local environment variables. You can pick up log files. You can change IIS config. You have pretty much all the control of the state of that machine. It's a big difference between that world and the world of cloud where, yes, you can put whatever software and install whatever you want in the role, but at any given time, the state of the machine cannot be guaranteed to be what you configure it to be. It can any time roll back to the original state. What that means is when you deploy an application, whatever state the machine boots up with is the state you should always assume. Because it's possible that one of your roles or one of your instances died, and Azure automatically spun up a new instance for you. Or you scaled up, and Azure automatically spun up another instance for you. So you cannot assume that if I remote desktop into a role in Azure, and I change some config, change some parameters, that setting will sustain. It will not. Because next time the machine gets rebooted and a patch gets applied, the setting is gone. So one fundamental difference in how you think about server and cloud is server, whatever state you left it in, unless there's a catastrophe, the server state remains. In Azure, it's guaranteed to not remain. Like, for example, every third month Tuesday, whatever it's called, the patch Tuesday, we will recycle the machine. So assume that your application will always go back to its on-deploy state. So that's one big difference. The other is when you're accessing the server to do monitoring or debugging, what you're looking at is the entire application if it's running on the one server. That's another big difference in Azure. One instance is what you're looking at any given time. If you have 10 instances, the runtime state of those 10 instances can be fundamentally different. So your server is your application is not just one server anymore. It's clones and clones of multiple instances. So that's if you keep those two differences in mind, a lot of your monitoring principles, a lot of the diagnostics principle will become pretty apparent and pretty obvious. Where one is a fairly static environment which you control, the other one is very, very dynamic. Machines keep coming up, keep going down, you don't have to worry about any of that. That's taken care of. At the same time, local access, even though you can remote desktop into them at any given instance, what's in the remote desktop, you cannot guarantee that to be there all the time. So with that fundamental principle, let's see how Windows Azure solves a diagnostics problem. So if you haven't used the Windows Azure Diagnostics modules much, WAD, this was called in short, or Windows Azure Diagnostics, essentially is designed for multi-machine monitoring, data collection, and diagnostics. So the whole design principle between WAD, or Windows Azure Diagnostics, is that multiple instances will be spitting out data that you care about. So hence, it's very, very important for you to be careful of what you want to collect, because when you go from one instance to 50 instances, you can get a lot of data very quickly. So, you know, if you're in the habit of doing trace line after every command, exit command, you know, you enter a method and you do trace line, it's good for debugging, but try to capturing that information across 50 instances and trying to, you know, make sense out of it is really hard. So be very careful about what you're gathering, what you're not gathering. Good candidates are pick up event logs with, you know, severity equal to error or severity equal to critical, but don't pick up verbose or information. But be careful about, you know, performance counters, event logs, app logs. You need to be cognizant of the fact that there could be a large number of instances that I could be collecting this information from. Same thing with, you know, the IIS request logs or crash dumps. So what to collect and how frequently to collect it is the biggest difference between how you do a single machine versus a large service monitoring. The good thing with Windows Azure Diagnostics is it helps you collate the data at the instance level and help you roll it up as well. So every instance automatically gets instance ID, a role ID, a deployment ID. So even if you don't instrument your application to spit out the metrics, at least for all the roles and instances, the Windows Azure Diagnostics automatically injects the right stamps so you can do collation and correlation pretty easily. And it's designed essentially to be very, very lightweight and low overhead process. So essentially, even if you have a large scale service using Windows Azure Diagnostics, it will help you scale even the diagnostics and debugging collection of the information itself. So you're not using any one machine to be a bottleneck for collection. Each node or each instance independently sends its data to storage. So the interesting thing is, and this is a recent change, which is now you can, even if you did not deploy your application with diagnostics turned on, you can always do it after the fact. You can do it remotely. So you can switch between a production app and then turning on diagnostics after the fact, and you can do debugging of live instances. That's a big recent improvement. The one thing to remember, and most customers just rely on Windows Azure Diagnostics only. It's a pretty powerful tool. But remember, with Windows Azure Diagnostics, you can only look at what's wrong within the data center. How your customers and your users are hitting your application on your website, you have no control over it. Because that's what you need to use services like Gomez, for example. So if you want to make sure that everyone can hit my website or everyone can hit my service endpoint, you should keep or you should still use an outside-in monitoring. There are a lot of services which keep pinging your service every 5 minutes, every 3 minutes, and send you an alert when it's not reachable. So Windows Azure Diagnostics is not a replacement for anything outside the data center. It helps you manage and diagnose applications within the data center. You can configure Azure Diagnostics to pick up any of these pieces of information. So it's pretty flexible in what you collect. And typically, the thing to get right and important consideration is which of these you really need when you have a service running in production versus staging versus when you're doing debugging. So pick the right level, and you can get pretty powerful information. Let's spend like 2 minutes to understand how Azure Diagnostics work. I'm going to show you this with a quick demo as well. When a new instance of a role starts, let's go back to the same web role. As soon as the role instance starts, if you've configured your onStart, actually, let me show this to you in code real quick. So what I have here is for my web role, as soon as my web role starts, and this is the method which is onStart, which is you have full control over what to do when my new instance is getting booted up. One of the things I highly recommend doing is when you enable diagnostics, you get the configuration and you start the diagnostics monitor. So typically, starting the diagnostics monitor on the role start will make sure that if you have any problem right from the time a machine's booting up, are things that you can control and start debugging. You can always start diagnostics monitor after the fact as well, or diagnostic collection after your role has started up as well, but then you miss out any events which are interesting when you were actually booting up the machine as well. And in this case, you're configuring which performance counters to go pick up, and you can keep, and in this example, all I'm doing is I'm picking up the CPU time. And that's probably one of the most useful things you can use for scaling, performance detection if there's a big memory leak or something is running in an infinite loop. So you can pick up performance counters, and the next step, you specify the time period in which you need to send the information from the local machine to a central point of collection, which is your storage account. And you can always do this on demand as well. So through API or through PowerShell or through the portal, you can also on demand transfer the logs, but this is the frequency at which the logs get automatically collected at the setting. So all of this, you know, we're doing it in the onStart method so that as soon as the machine starts booting up, your application is configured to be ready for doing diagnosis or even basic monitoring. So let's get back to this real quick and see, once the role instance starts, the diagnostic monitor starts as well. You configure what all you wanted to pick up, and at start time, you should at least pick up the base counters that you care about, like CPU or my event logs. But you can keep changing this even after deployment. So you can add more counters later. You can add more logs later. That's okay. Just pick the base minimum metrics you care about as part of the onStart method. And after that, you can keep remotely adding more counters. that's the other next thing is all this data collection first happens on the local instance. So let's assume you have 10 instances. All of these 10 instances will keep the local data data locally on the box. And it's a FIFO buffer. So if you're generating a lot of metrics and you haven't configured the local storage to be large enough, you will pretty quickly run out of that as well. So, for example, most people keep 1 gig as a local. You can extend that. It's completely in your control. And this is completely optional step, but highly recommended, is when you take the data from the instances and push it to a central storage location. The benefit is if your instance goes down, you still have the logs available from the machine which went down. So real quick recap, configure. As soon as it starts, add more later if you need to. Keeps it locally. Periodically keep pushing it. If you see a problem in, you know, when the app is running, you can always push it on demand as well. But keep pushing it on a timely basis. Okay. Skip through remote configuration. There's a whole bunch of simple samples to explain how you can keep changing the frequency of collection, frequency of pushing as well, after the fact as well, so you don't have to necessarily get it right when you're deploying the service. And this is the part you need to understand. If you're moving the data to a storage account, the Azure Diagnostics will automatically create the right tables with the right partitions for you, so you don't have to create a schema to keep all this information. All that is automatically created for you. And here's a list of all the tables and blobs that you will see if you enable Azure Diagnostics. So this is useful to understand where to go look when you're looking for information, but you don't have to learn about how to set this up. This is all taken care of as soon as you, in the onStart method, you call Azure Diagnostics. Actually, let me show this to you real quick. So this service that we just saw, right, has been running for a while. And what it does is, the sample is available, and after the talk, I'll make sure this is published on WindowsAzure.com as well. And you can start typing, through the sample, start testing a new error log. This logs an event to the local machine with the severity equal to error. You can change the severity level. And once it's done, every 1 minute, I've configured it to actually send the information to storage, but I want to show you the demo right now, so I'm going to transfer this log right now, which is the whole notion of on-demand. You can configure the logs to be sent. And in addition to sending the error event logs, you can also send performance counters. So once it's finished, I probably won't get to this part, but there's the whole notion about external and internal endpoints, I want to show that as well. But if you get access to the sample, which will be available, you can see every part of the talk about how do you configure internal endpoints, local and external endpoints as well. So fairly rich sample to do everything from basic configuration management to managing logs to doing diagnostics. So one sample application which takes care of pretty much everything you need to know about managing in Azure. So assuming this is 1 minute's done, let's go look at actual logs being collected. So this is the tool I was talking about. It's an open source third-party tool that New Desic built. It's called the Windows Azure Storage Explorer. There are a lot of these tools available. There's a Cloud Explorer tool as well. And what it's doing is I'm looking at my storage account. So a couple of different storage accounts. This one is called Mox Demos. What it does is it shows you all the folders and tables that got automatically created for me. So if you see WAD, anytime you see WAD, essentially it means Windows Azure Diagnostics. You start seeing all the configuration that's being kept for an instance. So for example, if you're just looking at the blob, you get to see the configuration file. You can also change it. So all the configuration is also maintained live in a storage account. So you can change either the buffer size. Right now it's 4 megs. You can keep changing the, 4 gigs. You can change all this configuration after the fact. That's exactly what the remote configuration tool really does. The interesting part to see here is if you see the tables, you'll see two sets of tables. One is called the logs, which where pretty much all the logs get normalized and sent to. You can also see performance counters. And this is going to be a big query, but let's actually reduce this to 1,000 rows. Wait. And what it's doing is it's across all the 6 instances that we just ran, it collects the performance counters from all those machines sitting in a storage location, and you can download this data as well. Come on. That's a bad idea to run 6 instances and get performance counters in a live demo. Luckily, I had downloaded this data. Oh, awesome. It actually collects all this. So if you, because there's a lot of information here, what you're seeing here is essentially that every instance and every process or every role is reporting different performance counters. So in this case, it's reporting the CPU and processor time, and you can start seeing the different values. So you can get an idea of what my average CPU consumption is, what's my peak CPU consumption, and of course, you can download this data as well. So what I'd done was, before this, I'd downloaded a snapshot before I started this demo, and this is the same information that we've just seen. And you can very easily run some queries on this and start getting an idea of how my CPU usage has been over a period of time. And you can start seeing when the spikes have been. So all this information is automatically collected for you. All I had to do in this case was when I'm developing my application, I specify that I want to collect the performance counter called CPU. And then in the onStart method, I define the fact that I want to start sending information to a storage account. And then I pull it out, and I can start building pretty fancy analytics in how my CPU gets used. The same information, as you had asked earlier, gets used if you want to use reactive rules. So you can see, there's been a spike in CPU. If spike happens more than 3 times in 1 hour, start spinning up more instances. So all this information is readily available in your storage account. You can download it and start using it. Of course, I'm running out of time. I can talk about this forever, so I'm going to skip through. We've already seen some of this. So let me get you to one important point we're going to leave you with in the last 1 minute. the things to remember when you're configuring your diagnostics is how much space you allocate in quotas on both the local instances as well as in your storage account. In the local instance that you're running, all the buffers are FIFO, so it'll automatically keep overwriting it. But the data you're sending to the storage account, that can start getting accumulated pretty fast. So something to worry about is, let me show you some number which will scare you first. So this is if you want to use PowerShell. But by the way, how many of you use PowerShell? Okay, 4. So I don't feel as bad about skipping this part of the demo. But yes, this is the part I want to make sure that they leave you with. When you're collecting data for diagnostics and monitoring locally on the instance, there's no cost to, implication to it. However, there is no guarantee that if the instance goes down, you'll be able to get to that data, and that's when you send to storage. But when you send data to storage, make sure you're continuously pruning it, because that data keeps sitting there forever and can get pretty expensive pretty quickly. And here's a quick math to show you what the cost is. So if you were picking up 5 perf counters, let's say CPU, memory, network, disk, I/O, and pick your favorite perf counter from your application. And if you have 100 instances, that's a pretty large application. So hopefully most of your applications, in normal case, should not be 100 instances. If it is, it's a beautiful application. We love it. But keeping, you know, if you're collecting every 5 seconds, that's also very high frequency. Typical average is 1 minute, 5 minutes, kind of varies. But you can just pay almost like $250, almost €200, only to keep the storage information for that logs. So be very careful with what you collect, when you collect, how often you keep it, and when you prune it. And even though that data is very rich, it can give you beautiful charts, but I don't think, you know, we can go back and tell our managers the chart looks beautiful but comes at $500 price. So it's good to keep that information, put it down, keep it locally. It's useful. So and I know I rushed through a lot of content. The point I want to leave you with is the platform is now rich enough and sophisticated enough that you can actually, whatever you do on premises today, you can do it and do it in a cloud scalable way, including doing fancy troubleshooting like IntelliTrace or remote desktop. And now it's flashing, saying my time's up, so I'm going to just leave you with a quick summary. There are a bunch of tools available, everything from deployment, configuration management, whether using continuous deployment with TFS or building your own build system. There are a lot of flexible options. So depending on your language type, depending on your runtimes, depending on how your company is set up, what process you use, you can pretty much find a combination of tools to go use. But knowing which one works for you, making sure it's secure, it's accessible, it's compliant, at the same time it's performant, doesn't cost you, is the right thing to go look at. And that's why, you know, these sessions, and we keep using Azure.com as a way to publish all the best practices, prescriptive guidance. So keep in touch in conversations. Love to hear some feedback on what works, what doesn't work, and what improvements we would love to see in the platform. So with that, thank you so very much for attending this. Appreciate your time. We'd love to take Q&A after this. Thank you.